Welcome to the Theology Podcast. It's great to have you with us. I am not C.R. Wiley. If this is your first episode, I think it'd be worthwhile for us to introduce ourselves so you know who it is you're listening to. My name is Glenn Sunshine. I am a senior fellow at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, Ministry Associated Reflections Ministries, and I have my own 501c3 called Every Square Inch Ministries. I'm a retired history professor specializing in Renaissance and Reformation Europe. Tom, take it away.
I'm Tom Price. I currently teach systematic theology, Christian ethics. I teach apologetics, philosophy, a host of other things. And one of the places is Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary.
And Annie, why don't you introduce yourself for our audience?
My pleasure. I'm Annie Crawford, and I am a classical educator, cultural apologist, and homeschooling mom. I teach great text, ancient, medieval, and modern, as well as apologetic classes for a classical community I helped found here in Austin, Texas. And as a cultural apologist, I write and speak on what I call the big S's, the three S's of our postmodern culture: sex, science, and story. You can find my articles at Salvo or Symbolic World and An Unexpected Journal, which is a journal of cultural apologetics that I helped to found in 2016. And lately, I'm doing a lot of work with the Society for Women of Letters, which is a group seeking to cultivate the life of the mind for women of all walks of life. And I'm a senior fellow there and editor for our new Substack, the Shadowlands Dispatch. And as a homeschooler, I am actually graduating my youngest daughter this year. So I'm about to wrap up that season. It's a big spring for us here.
Oh, very good. So Tom, why didn't you introduce us to the topic and where we'll be going today?
Okay, well, I think we'll begin with just maybe some general things, and maybe we'll hone into kind of some of the topic of emphasis that we kind of settled on in the last place. But there is a wide topic, and we kind of do this week in, week out, but we don't really talk about or to describe it, but it's something we're very much committed to and happy to see that you are as well, and that is cultural apologetics. And so maybe saying something about how you understand that so that our audience who may not have heard us talk about it in that language can kind of have an idea of the mission and the focus of that type of apologetic.
So I see C.S. Lewis as a model for most of the work that I do. And C.S. Lewis, I think it's in Blue Spells and Flanispheres, kind of an obscure essay. He says that reason is the organ of truth, but the imagination is the organ of meaning. So my approach to cultural apologetics is broadly based on that approach that you can't assess the truth value of arguments for the Christian faith or for the resurrection or for the existence of God if the content of those arguments has no meaning for you. If you don't have the right understanding, the imaginative understanding of the meaning of things, you're not going to be able to access that truth value. So I see cultural apologetics as working at the level of meaning, trying to help restore the meaning of things. And that can be done in two different ways. It can be done, I think Lewis modeled these two ways. That can be done at the level of telling stories, you know, using story and fairy tale to help illustrate the truth in a purely imaginative way. Or it can be done more at the level of a critic by trying to unpack story and metaphor and allegory for people. But broadly, I see cultural apologetics working at that level of meaning, which, you know, we hear everyone in the broader culture, the secular culture, talking about the meaning crisis right now. And so I see, you know, Lewis as a model for us of how to address that meaning crisis through this, you know, engaging the imagination.
Yeah, I think Lewis in particular was far ahead of his time in terms of insights he contributed. I think oftentimes he was seen, in his day and amongst some of his own colleagues and friends as sort of an eccentric in the sense that he spent a lot of his time in a world that, by the modern definition and the limits of the modern imagination, seemed outmoded and seemed like he was, you know, in his own little otherworldly sphere or sphere of interest. But we're beginning to see, I think, especially in as the crisis of meaning does start to take root more widely in every dimension, I think, of life, how much wisdom and insight his work actually contained and how it does point strongly in a direction that can help us orient ourselves as we try to wrestle with that same thing. Glenn, you had looked like you were itching to say something.
Well, actually, several years ago on a podcast, I talked about the idea of disenchantment. And, you know, we can connect this with Nietzsche, Death of God. There are any number of things that point in this direction. I think the reason why Lewis was so effective in this is that he saw more clearly, almost like Nietzsche did, what the implications were of a purely materialistic scientism, and realized that this would create ultimately this kind of crisis of meaning. Because if matter and energy are all that exists, meaning doesn't exist because it's neither matter nor energy. I mean, it's as simple as that. It isn't surprising, given Lewis's ability to look at the current trends and extrapolate where they're going, that he would be way ahead of the game on this particular point, along with a whole lot of others. Now, what I'm struck by with this is that when I was teaching a few years ago, I would be teaching history of Christianity in a state school. And I would always, their first assignment was read the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of John and let's talk about them. Because if you're going to study the history of Christianity, you have to know something about what Christians believe about Jesus. And I would always push it to discuss the resurrection. If they didn't bring up the resurrection, I would. Pointing out that, you know, according to Paul, Christianity stands or falls on the resurrection. And I would give them an apologetic for the resurrection. Okay. The point being, as I would tell them, my purpose in this class, emphasis on that, is not to convince you that Christianity is true, but it is to show you that it's not irrational. Yeah. And there were a lot of students who really agreed that the argument for the resurrection made a lot of sense, but they never made a connection that said that, therefore, this has something to do with my life. They never drew the connection between, yeah, this is true, this is real, and truth has some sort of claim on me. And what that led me to think is that what we need is a different kind of apologetic. And this is why I bring this up. And I've been arguing for a while now, and I haven't really been able to develop this much, that we need an apologetic built around imagination and beauty, which is exactly the kind of thing that you, Holly Wordway, and others are doing. So I guess what I'm saying is, I really like what you're doing, and I want to learn more about it, because I think it's absolutely essential.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Thanks. Yes. And I, you know, we mentioned, okay, Lewis is so prescient and so effective, and why? And one thing I've been thinking about lately, I just did 6 weeks of Plato with my high schoolers, you know, and I kept thinking about Lewis's statement, it's all in Plato. It's all in Plato. Bless me. You know, what do they teach in school these days? And you know, so why was Lewis so effective? You know, I don't think it's because he is a great saint. There's been many devout Christians, pious Christians. You know, I don't know that it's because he had the best theology. You know, I really think that what made Lewis so effective for a moment right now is his philosophical depth, right? And not philosophical in the modern sense.
Yeah.
When we think of analytical parsing, you know, propositions and analytical argument, but philosophical in the ancient sense of deeply formed in a vision of the good, of what is good, true, and beautiful. And I think, you know, the West was born out of the meeting between Jerusalem and Athens. Okay, not the church, okay, but the West was born in the meeting of Jerusalem and Athens, and that birthed this amazing culture that we are standing at the edge of. And I think Lewis's own journey kind of recapitulates to that. He called, you know, he said he was an old pagan and he loved Balder and he was an atheist, but it was being rooted through his studies in that ancient tradition, moving from atheism into Plato and idealism and then to theism. Being rooted in that old wisdom, I think, is what has given Lewis the ability to speak to us at such a time as this with such effectiveness, right? Because the old understanding, I mean, you just look at Plato. I was glad y'all did an episode on Plato a little while ago so I could kind of take a little bit of what he says for granted, right? That Plato, reason, I was talking to my students about this today, you know, wisdom and reason for the ancient person, for Plato, was not separate from the life of the heart and the imagination. It was really a unified vision of the person that I think is what allowed Lewis to respond with such, you know, incisive clarity on the issues that are facing us, but to do it also with imagination and heart. So some of what I've been interested in lately and wanted to talk to y'all about is, you know, how much Plato influenced Lewis, and that these men were both Plato and Lewis, and Boethius, if we want to put him in there too, were men who stood at the end of a world. Men who stood through the collapse, you know, because for Lewis, you know, the collapse of the West in Europe happened in the early 20th century and with the world wars. And so, and I think we forget that Plato also stood at the end of the classical age, that actually what was going on in Greek culture at that time was the collapse of Greek culture into the relativism of the sophists, Protagoras, you know, who would for a nice pretty penny make the weaker argument the stronger. You had the skepticism of Zeno, right? The reduction of knowledge to these absurdities. You had the total nihilism of Gorgias, who said, you know, there's no being, we can't know it. Even if we could know it, we couldn't communicate. And so you had this collapse of Athenian culture, a Nietzschean moment in culture, much like Lewis's moment, our moment, that Socrates was responding to and saying, you know, no, it's written on my heart. It's self-evident in the things that have been made. There must be a true truth and there must be a real good. Yeah. And you know, Socrates spent his life somewhat sacrificially, right, to try to sort through this, you know, this clouded mirror that we live in to grasp a vision of that good. Yeah. And I think, you know, the wisdom that they forged at the end of the Greek world, you know, really shaped Lewis and helped him to recover and preserve for us a wisdom that can help us rebirth our world.
And it's interesting, along with that, is just how significant a similar world was to the earliest church. I mean, this is, he's kind of following, he's following in his own, you know, psychological life and conversion, something that happened in Western culture overall. You had, you know, for several hundred years, the Hellenic culture preparing the way, if you will, with a universalized language and culture, that when Christianity moves out of those little locales of Jerusalem and, you know, into the uttermost parts of the earth, it connects with this almost, you know, a universality, a cultural universality in language. As a matter of fact, I always tell people the New Testament is written in Greek. Yes, it's a variation within it. But nevertheless, that's already telling you something about Christianity and its relationship to what has gone on, not merely in the Hebraic and Judaism, but also in this world shaped by these figures. Then you get the church, the earliest figures are already, on the one hand, distinguishing what is unique about Christ and the Christian conception of things, but they're also sometimes even blown away by just how much Plato, Aristotle, and some other figures did see, and how much that provided a set of lenses and tools to actually communicate in that you know, very wide culture, the gospel, by in many ways employing and sometimes converting its own language and terms. And so Lewis definitely steeped in that kind of disposition, similar to Augustine, recognizing there's a huge amount of value that by divine providence was prepared through all these philosophers. And even though, as you know, maybe Augustine would say, they had their best was splendid vices, nevertheless, in light of the gospel, they could actually be set free and become virtuous. So I think you really do see Lewis connected to really what went on with the whole bringing of the church into impacting Western culture.
Unfortunately, we have, I keep running into people who are followers of Tertullian here. what is Athens to do with Jerusalem? Where they just want to, you know, they somehow think that the influence of Hellenistic thought was the downfall of real Christianity, that it needed to stay within its Hebrew context. And, you know, what I think is remarkable as a church historian is the places where Christianity has been the most durable have been the places where you have the Hebraic, well, where you have Jerusalem and Athens both. Ethiopia is a bit of an exception there, but Christianity in India, the Mar Thomas Church, until it was revived during the Reformation, was a negligible force. It traveled across Central Asia, but it was destroyed by essentially Muslim expansion, particularly in the wake of the Black Death. And it never sets up strong permanent roots anywhere, except in those areas in the West, really, where you have that marriage.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Don Richardson's Eternity in Their Hearts?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yes, I wasn't, again, I was glad you all did the Plato episode so that I could feel assured that I wasn't about to encounter Tertullian in this conversation. you know, but I think another way to think of the meeting between Jerusalem and Athens is the meeting between general and special revelation.
Yeah.
And Jesus says he comes not to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. And I think, you know, one way of thinking about, you know, things into which angels long to look, if we think as angels as those given to superintend the nations, you know, not only did Jesus come to fulfill the law and the prophets, but the longings of the philosophers, you know, those who perceived as though from afar off a hint of that which was to come. Christ comes and does not destroy the law, does not destroy the prophets, does not destroy the philosophers or general revelation, but fulfills it. Yeah. You know, and you see in Socrates this longing to know the good, but he doesn't know the name, right? And I love Peter Kreef's dialogue when Socrates meets Jesus, and that Socrates was longing for the good, you know, and that's why Christ is called the desire of nations.
Yeah.
If the desire for that good was not in the nations, he could not come as the desire of nations and he who fulfills it.
Yeah.
But I think what helps, you know, those who are sympathetic with Tertullian is Don Richardson's framework, where you have the Melchizedek factor, but you also have the Sodom factor, right?
Yeah.
And that each nation that comes out of the Noah, that comes out of Babel, you know, has a memory of Eden, a memory, an inheritance of truth, and yet in this broken world, it gets twisted. And so there's always in the culture, you know, the Melchizedek factor, the remnant of truth, the general revelation, as well as the demonic factor twisting and distorting.
Yeah.
And so when Athens meets Jerusalem, when special revelation meets general revelation, of course, there has to be a proper sifting. But there should, and I think to your point, you know, as I understand from Don Richardson's, the missionary work that has had the deepest root and the most fruit is that which finds a Melchizedek factor to affirm, so that Christ can be received as the true longing of that culture, while, doing the important work of correcting the distortions that came along from being a sinful people in a broken world. You know, for example, with Plato and the Republic, you know, the reincarnation, you know, there's some errors. As much as Plato is able to see, there's some errors. And I make sure to walk through those, you know, with my students carefully, while also affirming, you know, the truth that was seen.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I think that, you know, that's well put. I think that we've tried to do a number of shows on that kind of issue. You know, talking about the way in which we are called to bring all things into conformity to Christ. That means all things. That means all knowledge and all wisdom and all truth, whatever its starting point. It's all a creation that is in bondage, that is still yet longing for its liberation in the freedom of the children of God. I mean, that's what you have here. It's not the eradication of creation, it's the freeing of it. And creation's echo in all of these cultures, however distorted, longing to be freed in that truth and refract the truth that it has for the world, like all creatures. And I really think that there is a lot there. And I think, you know, back to Lewis, I think Lewis captures this in so many ways. And he doesn't stumble over that. He understands that connection, I think even very early on, because it's a part of his story and his own conversion. I mean, he, reading George MacDonald and other figures early on, and how that, similar to Augustine discovering the Neoplatonists, brought them out of a kind of materialism or a kind of a very limited picture of reality. And I think on this point, I think connected to cultural apologetics, a lot of what I've done and tried to retrieve from my own end has been similar to what Lewis, I think, is doing on a wider scale, is that's recovering classic understanding of creation through using the riches of the classical world's understanding of ontology and metaphysics. I mean, I think especially his work with, you know, in the medieval material, especially, this is, I think, one of the areas that's hardest to get a hold of in a time that is, one, anti-theological, but also, you know, has an allergy to metaphysics. And when it does want to talk about it, reads it through Heidegger and ontotheology rather than what Lewis was up to. And so maybe just the notion for our audience of how much you see that as kind of central to the recovery of imagination and reason is that bigger metaphysical picture that Lewis is trying to, or well, is working with.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Y'all are making me think of a couple of things that when you said the New Testament was in Greek, and Greek creates kind of a universal language, that is, I think, what Lewis is doing with his metaphysical or philosophical competency. Because if you have a clear picture of the pattern of the world, right? And I do think Plato philosophically gives us the Christian categories for reality, right? Genesis says in the beginning, the heavens and the earth, the things seen and unseen, right? And when you have a well-formed, clear metaphysic, then what you can do is translate and transpose, right? So you can, and that's what he's doing, let's say, in like the silver chair. So I always have my students read the silver chair because it's the allegory of the cave, right? To help them. What's great about the silver chair and the allegory, it's the allegory of the cave, a critique of Freud, the ontological argument, and Pascal's wager, like all in one scene, right? Yeah. And so he's taking these very well-formed and clear philosophical principles that we need to make a good understanding of the world, and he's transposing them into the language of story and fairy tale, you know, a story that a 12-year-old could read and understand, or for adults, the Ransom trilogy. And so I do think, again, it's that wedding for him of a clear philosophical vision that will enable him to take the tools of general revelation and transpose it into the language of the moment, the metaphors or images that make sense to people in the moment.
Yeah, I would add one more thing into the mix here, and that's that Lewis was, I mean, I know a lot of people who are competent in history of philosophy, okay, you know, who really get it. But Lewis added to that myth. Mm-hmm. You know, he added to that an appreciation and a love for myth in general, especially the Northern myths. And that, I think, is also critical in this. It's not simply the philosophical side of it. It's the understanding of what myth is, how myth functions, how story works in that context, and the way this conveys meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And going back over Plato the last 6 weeks, I've been working a little bit on literary theory, and you know how Plato famously kicks the poets out of the Republic, yeah. Right? And yet, in book 10, he's like, you know, if anyone can convince me that poetry is actually helpful, I'd really love to let them back, right? Yeah. Because he loves poetry. And then the irony that Plato himself can't help but lay out his philosophy using myth. The allegory of the cave is a kind of mythic story. The myth of Ur, he has his noble lie. And so, again, that's where I wonder if our understanding of philosophy, I mean, maybe this is pushing it too far, but that reality is a story. And so if we're going to have a real philosophy, a true metaphysic, that metaphysic itself will include a narrative. Yeah. Because reality is a story. It is the story of God's, you know, creation. It's a creation and redemption and restoration of his people. And so I think that's why I find in Lewis, you're right, this union of reason and imagination, of philosophy and myth. But I think it was only a kind of fall that ever broke them apart in the first place.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I think there are different episodes in Western, you know, history where you see this happen. I mean, I often talk about the break that happened between realism and nominalism, because it's easier for me to show certain changes in theology that take place and how things start to split apart. And I know it's a lot more complicated down in the specifics, but you see these things, the breaking and the fragmenting of full pictures of reality and fuller pictures. You're right. From my familiarity too, I'm teaching again at the university level. I'm teaching philosophy, and it is stunning how a lot of students and a lot of the students I'm teaching have grown up in good, you know, somewhat good Catholic homes, but still how removed they are from philosophical education and of course the wider kind of imaginary literature. I feel like I'm starting out with I don't even know how to put it. I mean, just people who have no concept of any of this stuff. And on the one hand, that's okay, because I have them first year before they get all the junk they're going to be getting. But by the questions I'm asking, I'm noticing they're already filled with that junk. I'll give you an example, because this is related to especially your emphasis in retrieving this. And in education, is a lot of these students, I start to unpack, you know, just the basics of reasoning, the basic laws of critical thinking. And their default mode is it just doesn't matter, because for them, reason already has been detached from reality and from their meaning worlds. Their meaning worlds are defined by either popular culture and forces, right? Or what they think they've established for themselves from their own perspective, this hyper-subjectivism. And this is one of the things that the classic Christianity and these classic sources, and Lewis in particular, puts his material is one of the best buffers against that kind of fragmentation. And I think that that is one of the areas in which why socially and culturally we can't even talk anymore about what it means to be a human, a male or female, because those things are so torn apart and that full vision is so distorted that it's almost like having to start at the beginning with any conversation you have. And so I think, you know, I guess there's a challenge there, but in your turn to Lewis as sort of for renewing Christendom, where would you find a good outlet or entrance into that so that people can start building that kind of vision with their children and their, you know, people they want to educate?
Mm-hmm. It's a big question. I'm giving a talk on sex and gender at Houston Christian University Apologetics Day on March 23rd. If you're in the Houston area, come join. But, you know, the organizers told me I had 35 minutes, and I thought, oh, you know, Lord help, because exactly what you're saying is usually when I teach sex and gender, I take a weekend because I got to spend 4 hours just building up like categories and understanding of reality. So, you know, I think I get this, I think, from Stratford Caldecott. Forgive me if I have that wrong, but you know, we don't know what a human is. We don't know how to educate because we don't know what a human is. Yeah. We don't know what human is because we don't know what reality is. And we don't know what reality is because we don't know the one who made reality. Yeah. And you know, the same with sexual ethics. We don't know what marriage is or what sex is for because we don't know what a human is, because we don't know what reality is, because we don't, you know, and so trying to lay the building blocks to try and build up a coherent understanding so that sexual ethics doesn't seem like arbitrary rules, doesn't seem like someone trying to control you, but can make sense as God's good design for your flourishing, right? Yeah. So, you know, that's kind of explaining how I encounter your question. And I think for me personally, for some reason, it was self-evident 30 years ago that we were at the end of a world. It might be coming from a broken home, divorced family. I grew up in Oregon, which is kind of left coast. You know, very much the sense I had that I was living at the end of a world. And so when my husband and I, when we got married, you know, what brought us together was very much the mission that brought us together was, well, we summarize it in that great line by Gandalf, right? So he's in they're deep in Moria and they're standing on the edge of a chasm, and he's standing there as the Balrog rises, and the Balrog is wanting to tear down the whole fellowship and ruin the only hope for, you know, the future of Middle Earth. And he stands there, "You shall not pass." And so, you know, when we got married, that was just the vision that brought us together. That's our motto. So I have a sword on my wall, you know, that this generation, our call is to renounce the demons that have torn down our families and torn down our world, you know, to stand between them and our children so that we can reject the cursed inheritance and begin to rebuild anew. Yeah. And, you know, when we got married and I immediately had a couple little babies running around, it was clear to me that I had to homeschool them. And Plato in his Republic, you know, he thinks Athens is falling apart. I live at the end of the world. What is the just city? How do I rebuild a good city? And when he thinks about how to rebuild out of the ruins, he starts with education, right? That you have to rebuild. You rebuild the just city by rebuilding just men. And that begins at the beginning. And so, you know, this is one reason why I haven't pursued higher level academic work, is because I've really had a heart for helping homeschoolers be able to do a good job and to give their students and to redeem two educations at once, right? Yeah. As we educate our children, we can re-educate ourselves. And I really do feel that the classical homeschooling movement is the most important way we are beginning to rebuild from the bottom up. And, you know, that doesn't mean that there's grace. There's God's miraculous grace for all people at all places and all circumstances. But if we're going to strategize, you know, I think the wisest thing to do is for Christians to take the responsibility of educating their children, you know, in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, and forming their souls, not to make money or not to be popular, but forming their souls, to preparing them for the beatific vision, right? To love and receive that which is good and true and beautiful. That is our human inheritance, that it's our job to try and give our children the best we can. So, and in that work, you know, I look to Lewis. I think he's so effective because he had such an amazing education. And so people ask, you know, where's the next Lewis? Where's the next Tolkien? Well, I think they'll come out of a renewal of education and wisdom.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, you hit really on something we've been about a lot on the show, is the significance of homeschooling with this kind of thick classical education wedded to the larger Christian, you know, vision. And read through it that way. And it's interesting when you do look at Lewis. I mean, this is a lot of was preparatory, you know, for him in his life, whether it's his own library growing up at the, you know, his house, and just because he loved reading those stories, but also the way he loved that material, studying old words and reading old books. I mean, that was his thing. But who knew that he was actually mining a field of wisdom that was going to become such a service to a lot of Christians down the road? And I also think he's one of the first vehicles that also kind of, you know, what we call kind of a forerunner of the podcast and the pubcast. I mean, he took to, during the Second World War, if I remember right, he took to the radio and did bring into the imaginations of a society in suffering a lot of these ideas, which is, you don't typically see, first of all, a Don doing in the UK in those days. I mean, I know Bertrand Russell, I think, liked the, you know, the camera in his face whenever he could get it, or the microphone. But, you know, I mean, this was a different approach. And so he knew that it can't just stay in the corridors of, you know, the Oxford dining hall, that it was something that was for a much wider. And then he writes children's stories. I mean, yeah, people can say all the adults are, you know, largely the ones getting all the stuff. But no, the imagination is being penetrated in most fundamental ways. And I think of it often as, I mean, part of our, you know, civilizational tasks as human creatures is to educate and form our children to be good citizens and pursue the good. Coupled with the higher calling of making disciples and pursuing that in a distinctly Christian way. And I think of the kind of way that right now people are reaching and scrambling for resources because they're not going to get it out of public education. Mm-hmm. Some are aware of the homeschool. I think more people are increasingly becoming aware of it. But a lot of people don't know what to do. They really don't know how to get into it. I mean, I deal with a lot of the abstract metaphysical stuff in my academic work, but this is hard for academics. It's really difficult to get down to the level of everyone who really could benefit from it. So I think you hit something right. Lewis is one of these fascinating figures that is able to do both. And I think every time I read Lewis, I'm profounded as I grow in learning how much he was saying that I was missing. And yet he could still communicate it to someone like, you know, my son when he was 5, 6, or even younger with some of those stories.
Well, that's the mark of a good teacher. And I think Lewis even says that, I think maybe in Mirk, I don't remember where, but, you know, the mark of a real understanding is the ability to translate it into the simplest vernacular, right? Because yeah. I think it's like, I feel as I do about the gospel, also about philosophy, let's say. And the gospel can be, theology can be very complicated.
Yeah.
But it can be simple so that the humans to whom Christ has came can understand it. And a basic philosophical worldview, basic philosophy can be very, very complicated. But it can be simple, and what someone needs to know about reality, that there's a spiritual realm and a material realm, and there's an, you know, this can be known by everyone, and those fundamentals can be known, and I think it's part of what makes us human and gives us wisdom, and that is, again, why I like teaching high schoolers and even younger kids, is the challenge and the delight. Yeah. Of, you know, like Lewis did, taking these things that can be very erudite, very complex, but the essential truths can be known and can be understood. And I think, you know, we can take those for granted in a kind of, in a stronger culture, maybe in the height of Christendom, you could kind of just take for granted that intuitively, you know, basic understanding of the structure of being and that kind of, but we can't anymore. In this postmodern world, we can't take those categories for granted at all. And that's hard, you know, but that's the challenge we've been given. And hard things can be great things.
Yeah. Well, that's right. I think you're right about the taking for granted in other generations. I mean, you can even read figures that often people don't think knew metaphysical, you know, language and insight, but you can read a lot of Puritan figures that were as versed in it as anyone. I mean, read Isaac Watts, you know, logic text, or you could look at someone like the grandmother, or I think it was the mother or grandmother of the Wesley brothers, right? I read a little article not long ago of how profound her understanding of the metaphysical and ontological aspects of the imminent Trinity were. I mean, people can't, and most people in my systematic classes can't even get those categories down because they're hard. But that's how removed we are from a world that thinks and speaks and is penetrated by that, the richness that I think Lewis was working with and trying to salvage and keep going. It's interesting, Lewis, you know, you're familiar with this. I think you mentioned here, what do they teach in school these days? But it was something of a lay theologian. This wasn't his area of expertise, and he did not read any modern theology. Which is what I take to be his big credit. I did my dissertation work in modern theology, and not only is it, you know, an endless running around, if you put it that way, but it doesn't have the richness of what he found by studying the ancient material. It doesn't have the richness at all. And really, I mean, I look in like academic theology today, everybody was so profounded by like George Lindbeck at Yale, who came up with kind of the first steps towards a narrative theology or some other figures. And so they were trying to basically argue how significant story is and how significant, you know, the centrality of story to making reason make sense within a bigger picture. But their problem is they have such an allergy to metaphysics that story does a lot of what happens in people who emphasize redemptive history in like, you know, kind of a lot of the reform circles, is by emphasizing it but de-emphasizing the metaphysics that earlier Christians took for granted, they happen to be importing different conceptions and metaphysical understandings foreign to classic Christianity. And when they do it, all of a sudden, they start mimicking a lot of what the modern world around them holds to. You see it in the way they often read that text. I think a good place of seeing it is kind of a lot of the contemporary centered churches. Because I've been in and out of a lot of different church contexts, and I noticed this trend of language of, you know, we're here at church to find our own voice, right? Mimicking all the language of kind of the, you know, the therapeutic notion of theology. They're reading the same Bible. They're reading the same text, but not reading the same thing. And I think someone like Lewis, compared to what is going on in a lot of churches, exposes, and this is something he was really big on, reading old books exposes our own ways in which we've been shaped more by the now and the spirit of the age than we'd like to think.
Yeah, Lewis actually commented at one point that his favorite devotional reading was theology, was the old theologians. Your basic devotionals left him cold.
Yeah, I can't read them either.
Yeah. Well, he used to, what was his other one? And he'd when his friends were suffering and going through stuff, he'd give Boethius his Consolations of Philosophy to them. I think that was one of the, that's one thing I remember. It's not what I typically would give to my struggling friends, but I think there is some consolation there. Yeah.
One of the things I find interesting in this conversation so far is that I'm not supposed to admit this, mm-hmm. but as a historian, I started focusing on history rather than philosophy or other areas because I like stories. And when I taught, I always sort of instinctively taught using stories. Use the story to get to the analytical stuff that you need to get to, you know, like I said, as a PhD in history, that's not something I'm supposed to say, but I'm retired. So I can do that. But I am convinced that, you know, just from the level of history, if you can give people access to the lives, the histories, you know, the stories, which is what historia in Greek means. If you can actually give them access to that, it has the potential to open up a window into a different world, a different way of seeing things that you can't really get to just through analytical discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, what you're saying makes me realize that I've always approached philosophy as a story of understanding. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe why intuitively I was like, well, philosophy and myth, I don't see them, you know, reality mm-hmm. is a story. And I've always been fascinated with philosophy as the unfolding of, you know, man's understanding of reality, that the fall we lost our knowledge of who we are and how the world works, and the story of that recovery. I hadn't thought about it, but that before. And I think that's why, you know, I loved philosophy as an undergrad, but as soon as we got to, I missed my philosophy major by half a class because those upper level classes that got more analytical just were like sucking the life out of me.
Yeah, they moved away.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, they're terrible. Analytical philosophy is terrible.
Now, I have some good friends who are analytical philosophers, and I think there are those who are called and gifted to all areas of knowledge.
And there are some who make real contributions.
Yeah. I'm not saying that it doesn't have its place. I just it's like reading math textbooks for me. I am not a mathematician. There is a place for it, but I'm not going to be the one reading it. It doesn't have that kind of, like you say, it doesn't move me holistically.
The thing that killed me on philosophy was I read a book for one of my classes, and I read it in one sitting, which was probably the mistake. But I went to the class the next day convinced that I didn't understand the book. And I found out in class that, in fact, yes, I had understood everything that was in it. And I walked out thinking, if this is, and I asked the professor, Stuart Hackett. I asked him, I said, you know, is it my imagination or is this book a little bit obtuse in terms of making its point? And he replied, and I quote, I still remember this, "To the contrary, I consider it a model of lucidity." And my reaction was, okay, it takes real talent to write a book that communicates everything in it effectively, except for the fact that you actually understand it. If this is a model of lucidity for philosophers, I'm going to be a historian.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Stuart Hackett, to his credit, wrote a fine ethics text. It's not easy. Nothing Stuart Hackett wrote was easy, but it was called "A Rediscovery of the Highest Good." So it actually kind of salvaged, I think, his.
Yeah, he did. Well, the Resurrection of Theism was another good one.
Yeah, and Reconstructing Christian Truth Claims was, I think, one of his kind of claim to. But that was a different generation who, at least, he could speak to people, I think, still in the academic world that would know what's going on.
Seriously eccentric, though, let me tell you.
Yeah. I've heard stories. I don't know if you've heard of Stuart Hackett. I think, where was he? Was he at Trinity?
I had him at Trinity.
Yeah, Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. He was like William Craig's teacher. He was a generation. Okay. He had a generation or two of people that kind of went on into it. But it just shows you that, you know, philosophy can be very hard to access. And Lewis is one of these figures that caught and captured kind of the heart of it and was able to work with it. Of course, you know, Lewis is a master of language as well. And that mm-hmm. is a big deal that for the communication and integrating any of that stuff. I was reading recently Augustine's City of God again I'm doing a social ethics and social issues class, and I'm trying to give them a better frame than the ones they're getting in the kind of biblicism in textbooks, which has its place, but a very limited place because it doesn't capture these exact points, the metaphysics, the way in which that, you know, that story actually penetrates reality the way they do. They see it mainly as, here's a bunch of proof texts. Which ones do I agree or not agree with, and which ones fit my kind of my political dispositions? So it really just seems like you get to apply the Bible any way your deep convictions want you to, rather than having to conform to reality. And so one of the things I noticed in Augustine is he's criticizing yet complimenting basically pagan Roman, you know, Rome at the time. And on the one hand, he's saying, look, you have had this immense empire. you have obviously developed things like strength and the capacity to develop a civilization that is in many ways glorious and to some extent. But again, those things that are your strength are also the things you're enslaved to and also you're going to be your undoing. And one of his criticisms was their education. And he said, what you promote in some of your better moments, certain kinds of self-discipline, pursuing kind of higher common goods, is undermined by, you know, he basically said the demonic religion that you're tied to, the religion that allows you to have libido dominante, right? The lust to dominate that enslaves us, or the sensuality that governs your shows. But then he points to the fact that Christian churches, and he can point to something at the time, have something remarkable about them because they have developed themselves into cathedrals of education and learning. And that kind of took me back, because you'll think of it maybe for, you know, Bible class, theology class, some kind of something to help. But to see them as formative holistically, he was talking about moral and virtue formation in that context. And I'm just thinking, I mean, where do we typically get the point to today where we see that happening? And I think that's really a place at which maybe homeschooling begins to be one of those areas that are invested in these sources where you see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're making me think of several things. I might dare take the motto that a lot of my work is the effort to make philosophy great again. And in the sense of the love of wisdom. Right. Yeah. So the ancient understanding of philosophy was to, you know, think of Plato, to perceive the good, the truth that is the good, the pattern of reality, so that I can live in harmony with it. That wisdom, the ability to see truth, the understanding of truth, was fully integrated with even a kind of worship, right? A desire and an obedience to live in harmony with it. And a revival of philosophy in that sense is, I think, important for this recovery. And, you know, I feel like to be a little more positive. So, you know, I've said one tactic is the homeschooling movement, to be able to form kids from birth, you know, from the beginning in this rich understanding of goodness and beauty and truth and wisdom and the integration of theology. Another way I see my work is the integration of education and discipleship. This union of philosophy, or, you know, truth and theology, this unification. Sorry, I'm thinking like 12 thoughts all at once.
That's okay. That's all. Yeah. We do that every week. And okay.
You know, part of the making philosophy great again and a recovering of I think a fuller understanding of philosophy is to acknowledge what reason is. So I find in conversations often that we're equivocating on the understanding of reason. Mm-hmm. So if I can go to Plato's analogy of the line, and he has, you know, conjecture and opinion. Okay, but when we get to truth, there's two levels there. There's the dialectic or maybe analytic, and then the noetic. Or if I can use the Latin terms, which Lewis uses in The Discarded Image, there's ratio, discursive reason, and then intellectus, or perceptive reason. And in our modern world, we have, I think, largely ignored or misunderstood. We focused on analytical, discursive, dialectical reason. And then that's why, you know, Tom, you're saying your students feel like, really, Plato didn't let you study philosophy till you're 50, because he didn't want people to do this, to use logic and reason, ratio, as a weapon. Cut away the things they don't like, and and that what is the higher source of knowledge is a noetic knowledge, intellectus, a direct perception of what is good and true, which Christians understand to be a gift of the Holy Spirit, you know, from Christ, who is the light of the world, who illuminates all minds and hearts. And so I think for Christians, recovering a proper understanding of philosophy is understanding a proper understanding of the noetic.
Yeah.
Right. And that, you know, as Plato emphasizes and Lewis emphasizes, there is a you cannot understand truth without virtue. That that noetic perception of the truth is something that comes through holiness. Right. Yeah. Which is what Paul says, is that it's spiritually discerned, that a bad person, Plato talks about, can't see the truth.
Yeah.
Because to see the truth will be to love it and bring your soul into conformity with it. So I think part of this recovery that we're doing, you know, that I think applies somewhat to the higher university level of helping students, again, understand the difference between, you know, a better understanding of reason itself.
This I think ties in, you know, where we lost it ties in with a whole bunch of different things. But one of them, again, is materialism, scientism, that basically says ratio is the only thing that qualifies as knowledge. And intellectus is up, well, what Schaeffer called in the upper story. It's not real. It's not objective. It doesn't have any factual basis. It's not true knowledge. And I think that all of this has led to a thorough disintegration of identity, of culture, of pretty much everything. And I've been thinking this for a while now, and I've been rather intrigued because you keep talking about integrate this. That's exactly the project that we need to be doing now, is trying to help people to reintegrate their minds, their hearts, their lives, their way of seeing the world, the recognition that matter and energy aren't the only things out there. You know, all of these kinds of things. It seems to me that's the essential thing that needs to be done now. And in some ways, the culture is certainly militating against this directly, but it may be helping us in certain respects, in that the postmodern world has really pretty clearly demonstrated the limits of modernity and ratio. It also has opened up to a lot of my undergrads the idea that there's an invisible world out there that's just as real as the visible. You know, so there may be things that postmodernism has given us inadvertently that we can use to help in this process of reintegrating.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you know. I know we're as Chris would say, we're about to bring this in for a landing, but it has been a very fascinating topic, and maybe it'd be good at some point to have you back on to talk more about the sacramental dimensions, because I know that is tied with this. And I think just on a kind of ending thought from my end is that I think that emphasis on discipleship is right where this kind of points for Christians, because especially with the work the early church did, it was Christology and the doctrine of the incarnation that tied all this together. It took the rich insights of that vibrant Platonic vision. It purged it of those elements, or it was a work of purging. It took time, and you know, continuously we're on guard, but it purges those elements out that were, you know, weren't the full truth, and it does integrate them into this rich, vibrant understanding of reality and the way in which our constitution is oriented to reality as creatures, even in that fallen and brokenness, that you have this complicatedness, because on the one hand, our hearts only rest when they rest in Him, but on the others, we're looking around the visible for what only the invisible can give us. And Christ bringing the invisible in the most intimate connection to the visible afresh and redemptively becomes the avenue in. There was actually a great source, Anna Williams wrote, I think it was Anna Williams from Cambridge, if I remember, it was called The Divine Intellect. And it looks at the transformation of from the Platonic kind of pagan world to all the way up through Augustine and further, the conversion all these categories and the way they become placed within a robust Orthodox Christian understanding of Christology. But anyway, that was a long exit point. But my thing is, thank you so much for coming. Any last thing, Glenn? I'll start with you and let you have the final word there, Annie.
Yeah, one of the things I'm kind of intrigued by from what you said is this being sort of the end of the Western world. I think a lot of us have been suspecting that, but it was a little bit startling when you came flat out and said it. And so that's an issue that I think is also worth exploring at some point, but it's obviously we are now slightly over an hour and we're supposed to be stopping. So we can't do that now, but that's another area I would like to explore at some point, because I think for many Christians, especially in America, the idea that, the Western world could very well be on its last legs now, I think is a profoundly disturbing idea, because they've identified Christianity with the West. And I think that there's a fundamental category error there. Mm-hmm. So that's something I think that would be worth exploring further at a later date.
Well, that ties in with the last thought that I had, that part of, again, Lewis's effectiveness is he had a clear, well-formed picture of reality. And as we said, part of reality is a story. And there is a pattern to the way that stories lay themselves out, right? And so that's why if we can see that pattern, and we've seen it repeat again and again and again as cultures rise and fall, then we can, see the pattern playing out in our own world and act with wisdom. And my encouragement for Christians is, I repeatedly see the church about 2-3 decades behind in their response to things, right? And so my encouragement is, take courage, dear heart, and accept the time it is.
Yeah.
And then respond with the hope that we have in Christ so that we can respond effectively. Hopefully we could get back together and talk about, I do think it's the end of the world. And as you point out, I do think that gives us some opportunities. Actually, we can see it as an opportunity, and we have been given models. People have gone before us that we can look to imitate. Maybe we could call it the Phoenix option, right? You got the Benedict option. We call it the Phoenix option, right? Of how to rise up out of the ashes as those who serve a resurrected Lord.
I can't end on a finer note than that. Those were encouraging and hopeful words. Annie, we thank you for joining us. We do, we do hope you'll come back and we'll share some more. Also, I believe you have some different links. So if we can afterwards, through an email exchange or something, any kind of sites or articles or things you'd like us to link in the show notes, would be happy to include those. Glenn, you had a last point?
No, I was just going to note that you've come to the end of another episode, and all of the usual things follow from there. The reference to the Patreon, funding for the trip, and so on, but I'll let you catch those on a different episode.
Thanks, guys. This has been fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming, Annie.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
The Theology Pugcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. To learn more about the church, you can visit trinityreformedkirk.com. trinityreformedkirk.com.